Depending how you've grown up, you have different kinds of people talk about original wounds, you know, founding traumatic experiences of one kind or another. And actually, speaking of movies, they can be one of those. For your grandparents, it may well have been when Bambi's mum got shot. For your parents, when Artax drowned in the swamps of sadness. Perhaps for you, it was when Mufasa died. if you haven't seen Lion King by now, Romeo and Juliet both die. Jesus, you think he's dead, comes back. Or maybe your original wound goes to the tune of, when somebody loved me, everything was beautiful. Every hour we spent together lives within my head. And when she was sad, I was there to dry her tears. And when she was happy, so was I, when she loved me. So the years went by, I stayed the same, but she began to drift away. I was left alone. Still, I waited for the day when she'd say, I will always love you. Lonely and forgotten. Never thought she'd look my way. And she smiled at me and held me just like she used to. Like she loved me. When she loved me. Jessie the cowgirl. Beyond Blue helpline is available 24/7. as you deal with that kind of... Wow. You know, Toy Story 1, 2 and 3. We didn't need a 4, it's fine, but no one asked for it. Here's one blogger's reflection on Toy Story, the films, and their depth, their profundity. Toy Story, 1995, was a kid's film about toys that came to life when no one was watching. It was witty, exciting, strangely poignant. It was also a parable about the dangers of jealousy and insecurity and the importance of friendship, loyalty, self-awareness, and the ability to understand and accept one's place in the world. Things get heavier as we hit Toy Story 2, 1999, all about accepting that nothing lasts forever. So enjoy it while you can. It was about the inevitability of loss. It was coming to terms with mortality. Toy Story 3, 2010, it's mostly about facing mortality head on. How do you react when your time is up and you're finally facing that nothing will last forever? Another blogger, actually a Guardian review back in 2010, said, but before I became a parent, you know, I thought about these films, you know, in this kind of way. I think I generally understood it. But then one day I had this great realization, the true meaning about Toy Story, that we, the adults, are the toys. One day our children will get bored playing with us. They don't want to be cuddled with us. They don't want to confide in us. They will go away and leave us. It will never be the same again. The toys in Toy Story 3 are sent away to a daycare centre where they are victimised and mistreated, just like the infantilised inmates of old people's homes. Loss, change, grief, death. This is the tyranny of time. It's painful. It's heart-wrenching. It's heavy. How do we cope with our place? How do you cope with coming to terms with your place in the world? How do you live in a world where change just keeps on happening? It empties life of its stability and joy, where nothing lasts forever, where death awaits. That's the theme of this heavy book, Ecclesiastes, that we're looking at across this whole semester. It's heavy, but with its heaviness comes deep wisdom. Yeah, a wisdom that can help us chart our world through this world of grief and loss and change. And it asks the question, chapter 1, verse 3. It's helpful to have Ecclesiastes in a paper Bible or on your phone, as we're going to refer to it a lot. And you'll keep up with me, as well as retain better the information if you track along with these verses and look at them as well as hear them. 1, verse 3, it asks the question, what do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? What gain is there from wisdom or folly, from pleasure or work, from nature, from human civilization, from good deeds, from religion, from love and romance and family? What gain in the end? From one perspective, from an under the sun perspective, as Ecclesiastes keeps talking about, under the sun, It's meaningless, meaningless, utterly meaningless, 1 verse 2. Everything meaningless. It's the word translated for us here as meaningless captures the idea of a fleeting, passing, temporary fog. There's all sorts of types of literature in the Bible. The Bible's like a compendium of books. It's not one book in a sense. It's a book made up of books. There's law, there's history, there's theology, and then there's this. Because God in his wisdom knows, in order to make sense of everything in the world, you don't just need laws and rules, rituals, gospels. You also need this kind of stuff for this kind of world. It's a messy world. It's a painful world. It's a riddle of a world. And so we have this riddle of a book that actually helps us get the hang of living in a world. If you're like recipe person, control person, everything in its place person, black and white thinking person, Ecclesiastes kind of grabs that and rips it all up and messes up your neatly ordered bookshelves. You can't completely control everything, predict everything, understand everything. It's good for you. Ecclesiastes stretches you, challenges you, shakes you. Or maybe you do feel emotionally, mentally, logistically already in chaos. Then maybe Ecclesiastes, you go, oh, you get me. You can flip open this book of the Bible and go, oh, there's space for this too. There's space for me, you know, in this. You go, it's a way in. Makes you think, makes you feel, and equips you. One writer who reflects on this book, Bruce Voltke, says Ecclesiastes is not just written like some dry, you know, proving everything's meaningless so you'll become a Christian, but it's actually agonizing struggle of an honest man wrestling with his absurd existence and exhorting us to fear God in the middle of it. Or Derek Kidner, another writer, says that the author of this book, the teacher, is a real citizen of this tantalizing world. He feels acutely the futility he describes. He burns at the injustices and disappointments of life and mourns the passing of youth and the universality of death, even while he bids us to set our hearts not on earthly vanities themselves, but on the Creator, from whom we can gladly, responsibly accept the good of life with all its enjoyment for what it is. But in God alone is the eternity, the forever, which he has made us conscious of. So with that in mind, we turn to the theme of time in chapter 3, the tyranny of time, describing these realities under the sun, under the heavens, 3 verse 1. Look there at 3 verse 1. There's a time for everything, a season for every activity under the heavens, under the sun, in this world. It seems kind of meaningless. Cycles, futility, transience, absurdity, vanity, a painful puzzle. And yet at the same time, it's from the hand of God. 1 verse 13, I applied myself to understand and study and explore all the wisdom that is done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. 2 verse 24, a person could do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in the toil. This too I see is from the hand of God. 3 verse 10, I've seen the burden that God has laid on humanity. God's with him in all this. God's with us in all this wrestling angstiness. And so here we go with this poem, 3 verses 1 to 8. Let's read the whole thing again. I mean, it's hard not to think of since the invention of clockwork, the ticking of a clock, perhaps the original readers would think of just the beating of the heart, you know, the breathing of the lungs, the lapping of the waves, but it's the passing of time, tick-tock, splish-splash, ba-dum, ba-dum, whatever it is. Here we go. There's a time for everything, a season for every activity under the heavens, a time to be born, time to die, time to plant, time to uproot, time to kill, tick, time to heal, tock, time to tear down, a time to build, a time to weep, a time to laugh, time to mourn, time to dance, time to scatter stones, a time to gather them, a time to embrace, a time to refrain from embracing, a time to search and a time to give up, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to mend, a time to be silent and a time to speak, time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. It's the second of these grand poems in the book. Chapter one has one, reflecting on the cycles of nature. Here, the rhythms of time. The end of the book, we have one about old age, picking back up the theme of time and mortality. What's the message of the poem? That just it's all yin and yang, there's kind of a bit of this, bit of that, and a blotch of each in either? Well, I think it's, as the commentary afterwards goes on to explore, I think on the one hand, there is a certain bleakness to it. Yes, it is saying, even if there is a time to be born, there's a time to die. Even if we plant, eventually things are uprooted. Even if we build, things will be torn down. So 3 verse 9, what do workers gain from their toil? I've seen the burden God has laid on humanity. 3 verse 15, whatever is has already been, what has been will be before. God will call the past into account. There's a bleakness to it all, a grimness to it all. In part, the whole of Ecclesiastes is like a meditation on Genesis 3, the curse of the world. Sin has entered the world, death has entered the world, decay has entered the world, futility, meaninglessness, vanity has entered the world. Bleak, part of the message of the poem, but also there's a puzzle to our experience of time and life. It's grim, but it's not just grim. It never is just grim. And that's part of the puzzle as well. It's that there is a time to be born, and there is a time. If you've seen someone get to that point at the end of their life when it's sad to see them go, but it's time that they go. There is times and seasons for engaging and withdrawing. There is a grim, hard time when in this world war might have to be waged and so on. There is some sense of meaning in it, that actually time brings some degree of helping make sense of life. As you live out ethics, you need to look at principles, values, also roles and nature, you know, you and your role in relationship to others and the environment around you, you know, so the nature of things. But you also need to look at the season or the time, that often there is an appropriate time for something and other times when a slightly different thing is called for. Yeah, so time is another function of ethical behaviour in the world. So 3 verse 10, I've seen this great burden God has laid on humanity, 3 verse 10. But then 3 verse 11, he has made everything beautiful in its time, that there is some sense to things, even hard things. They have their place. He has also set eternity in the human heart, and yet, here's the puzzle again, no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. God's work is in it all, through it all. 3 verse 14, I know God. Everything God has done will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be taken away from it. So God has got something. He's up to something. He gives a meaning to then time, but we can't. So the meaningless idea captures both this transient, futile, fading, but also a puzzling, riddling enigma. It's ponder those a little more in turn. The tyranny of time, its relentlessness. Like Jessie the cowgirl, like Mufasa, like, well, we will all be born, we'll all age, we'll all die, be forgotten. There's a time for love, and then there's a time when love falls apart, grows cold, friendships even drift. There's time for war, and there's a time for peace, resolution, diplomacy. All these things will happen in their time. You can't change the time. There's no point. Ecclesiastes 7 verse 10 says something that was true way back, 1000 BC or whatever. It's still true today. 7 verse 10 says, don't say, oh, why are the older days better than these days? It's not wise to say such things. Nostalgia. Nostalgia was there way back 1000 BC. It's here in 2026. Oh, it was better back then. Why can't things be this way? There's no sense in that. You're in the time you're in. We're passengers through time, victims before the sands of time, the waves of time, the ticking of the clock, 13, 3 verse 14, 15, I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be taken from it. God does that so people will fear him. Whatever has already been and what he has been, whatever is has already been, whatever will be has been before. God will call the past into account. It just grinds on. Can't escape it. Can't tech your way out of it. You can't transcend into the cloud to escape it. You can't skincare your way out of it or... You've been sown into the passage of time. What is, what will be, is what we're living through, and it comes to an end. We need to get a sense, Ecclesiastes keeps telling us, and this poem rubs into us, we need to get a sense again just how vast the ocean of time is, how small we are in it. It makes light of our boastful bragging ambition, the saber-rattling and bragging that some people are given to, the kind of vanity and self-absorption, the intensity with which we think our life is so... it's just the illusion that we're the centre of the universe. We need to feel the burden, verse 10, that God has laid on us. It is a burden. It's God's burden. We inherit it as those... a part of a human race that's turned away from God, that loses the life-giving harmony of relationship with our Creator and becomes just like any other ant or plant, just mortal, drifting through this ocean of time, cut loose from our Creator, the author of life, to dust and thorns and toil and ashes. One of his short stories, Jean-Paul Sartre describes someone on death row coming to the sense of this, the appreciation of this tyranny of time. The first person narrator says, at that moment I felt I had my whole life in front of me and I thought it's a damned lie. It was worth nothing because it was finished. I wonder how I'd be able to walk, to laugh with girls. I wouldn't have been able to move so much as my little finger if I'd only imagined I'd die like this. My life was in front of me, shut closed like a bag, yet everything inside it was unfinished. For an instant, I tried to judge it. I wanted to tell myself, this is a beautiful life, but I couldn't pass judgment on it. It was just a sketch, a scribble. I'd spent my life counterfeiting eternity. I'd understood nothing. I'd missed nothing. There were so many things I could have missed, the taste of manzanilla or the baths I took in the summer at a little creek near Cadiz, but death had disenchanted everything. In the state I was in, if someone had come and told me I could go home quietly, they would leave my life whole, it would have left me cold. Several hours on death row or several years of waiting is all the same when you've lost the illusion of being eternal. Lost the illusion of being eternal. I clung to nothing. In a way, I was calm, but it was a horrible calm because my body, I saw with its eyes, I heard with its ears, it was no longer me. There's a grasping, a right, healthy, wise grasping of our own mortality that makes us wise. And so Ecclesiastes shakes us with that fact. The relentlessness, the bleakness of the poem. But what was the other thing? Its puzzling, enigmatic nature of time is the other thing it points out. God makes everything beautiful in its time, 3 verse 11. There is a time to plant and a time to uproot. That time and seasons and rhythms and asking the question, what's the time right now, can be a really helpful question as you make decisions. What should I be doing next? You can ask, well, what time is it? What's the time now? What's the right thing now? Sometimes time helps you figure that out. Even the earnest, zealous, passionate Christian, you always want to be glorifying God, and that's a great thing to do. But sometimes the next thing to do is do the dishes because it's your turn to do the dishes. It's not glorious, spectacular and, you know, spiritual, but that's the time. It's the time for leading youth group, tick, and the time for just, would you do the dishes, talk. You know, sometimes you go, what's the time? I should be, if you're convinced that it's really important to tell people about Jesus, the time to mission, tick. But hang on, you've also got friends and family, maybe a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and so there's a time for actually just being with those that God has given you to particularly love and care for, talk, you know? And so there's this, again, that in the riddle of it all, time has certain sense. And even ugly things can have a kind of beauty in the riddle of God's plans, 3:14, that God is doing something bigger that will endure. There's such a thing as an ugly beautiful. There's such a thing as friendship and courage emerging from awful trials. That things can have a good place in the worst of seasons. I mean, that observation, everything beautiful in its time, is very true for Christians who understand what God did in the crucifixion of Jesus. What uglier thing could there be? What more uprooting, killing, hating, tearing down, mourning thing can there be than taking God come to earth to be with us, betraying him, crucifying him, cursing him? And yet that was the most beautiful thing. The old country musician Johnny Cash has a beautiful song that paints that picture. It's a song well worth listening to. You can find it on your Spotify or whatever else. Redemption, it's called. Johnny Cash sings, "From the hands it came down, from the side it came down, from the feet it came down and ran to the ground. Between heaven and hell a teardrop fell. In the deep crimson dew the tree of life grew. And the blood gave life to the branches of the tree. And the blood was the price that set the captives free. And the numbers that came through the fire and the flood clung to the tree and were redeemed by its blood. From the tree streamed a light that started the fight. Round the tree grew a vine on whose fruit I could dine. My old friend Lucifer came, fought to keep me in chains, but I saw through the tricks of 666. From his hands it came down, from his side it came down, from his feet it came down and ran to the ground. And the vine engrafted me, and I clung to the tree." Everything has its place. God is working out a plan. We may not be able to fathom it from beginning to end, but there's not only am I abandoned to the ocean of time, but there is a sense in which above that ocean, above the heavens, there is actually also another warm pond I rest in, which is God's will and God's purpose, that God is working out something grander. A person who hasn't heard God's full revelation, they get a sense there's something more. There must be a God, people wonder, or surely there's some right and wrong, people insist, or at least there's some meaning out there, even if we don't know what it is. And they're right. The person who says there's something, there's a right and wrong, I'm pretty sure there's a God or at least a spirit, well, they're right. Yeah, there is something. And ultimately, that as God speaks from above the sun, he tells us what that something is, unpacks the riddle, brings us to something better, that we're not abandoned only to confusion, only to despair, only to relentlessness. There's something more. There is a goal to time, an end, a meaning, a purpose, a truth, a target to time from God, who gives a shape to it. That there... God has a plan, a season for everything, that God makes things beautiful in their time, that God is working towards something. So then how do you live in the midst of that? Is it tyranny of time, bleak, mysterious? How do you live in time? How do you and I, how do all of us, you know, take all that philosophy, you know, pondering, poetry? How do you live in the midst of it? Let's think about that then. Living in time. That he goes on to talk about exactly that. 3 verse 12. Have a look. Here's his first bit of advice. Enjoy life. I know there is nothing better for people to do than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in their toil. This too is a gift from God. I know that God does everything. Everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added. Nothing can be taken from it. God does it so people will fear him. And right down to the very end of the chapter, the same theme is returned to right at the very end. I saw there is nothing better for a person than to enjoy their work because this is their lot. Who can bring them to see what will happen after them? He says, if you're going to live through all this mystery, paradox, riddle, grief, traveling through time, knowing death's to come. He says, you know, you enjoy life while you got it. There's a place for that. Recognize your place, your lot in life. Embrace it. And live the life you've been given. Even the Bible recognizes that regular kind of truth. Yeah? There's a great bit in the Lord of the Rings films where Frodo says, I wish the ring had never come to me. I wish this had never happened. I wish I had a different time, right? I wish I had a different place, different job. Then Gandalf the wizard says, yeah, so do all who live to see such times. But that's not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that's given to us. There are other forces at work in the world besides the will of evil. The ring was meant to come to you, and that's an encouraging thought. Knowing you have a place in a larger plan, knowing that you have a lot in life, even if I can't comprehend everything, even if I can't control everything, even if I can't guarantee everything, even if I can't govern everything, I've got a little plot of land to keep and to tend. I've got a few people to love and to learn from. I've got a job to do. And Ecclesiastes says there's some wisdom, some sense, once you realise what you can't control, once you realise how small we all are, do what you've been given. Do it well, do it joyfully, then go to bed. Receive God's good gifts. These are a gift from God, he says. Don't scrounge after trying to gain and control, but just have a more peaceful demeanour to say, I've been put in this place with these people and these gifts. Receive them. Perceive the beauty of the time you are in. Find pleasure in what you do, even the burdens, as Mary Poppins sings. You snap and the job's a game. Find a way to find pleasure in the grind. There's various ways that cultures talk about what's important in life. And, one way of doing that is maximising time, productivity, seizing every hour and minute. And there's great wisdom in that. And we'll come back to that theme in just a minute, that there is something good in saying, how can I use my time well? But often that focus reaches a fever pitch and people kind of collapse in a heap, because you can't, we are merely frail creatures and we can't sustain that endlessly. You've got to rest. And so often you then have a reactionary force. So one recently was there was a whole lot of time telling women about how you can have it all, go be the girl boss, control everything, build everything. You got it, girls. And then there was a reaction to that called girl moss, which is, sometimes there's a time to say, you know what, just go into a forest and just don't boss anything. You don't got this. You got a log. There's some moss on the log. Have a nap. Read a book or not. That's fine too. Have a smoothie. Zero protein and lots of sugar in it. There is a time to be a bit more girl moss than girl boss. Time for both, but to enjoy life. And look, even as Christians, again, devout Christians, passionate Christians, change the world Christians, preach the gospel Christians, love your neighbour, love your enemy, do good. We're going to get to that next. There is also a time for enjoying the world God's given you, to unplug, to sit on the log, to rest. Because we can slip into a sort of works-based religion so easily as Christians. We know we're saved by grace. We know it's all a gift of God. But so easily we go, yeah, but also kind of God needs me to maximise. He needs me to Christian boss it, because otherwise we're in real trouble. And so you've got to actually have a Christian version of this stuff, Christian existentialism that says, just be in the moment. This is God's moment. Enjoy life. Secondly, how do you live through time? Do good. So he does say, it's not enjoy life and then just chill until you're a puddle. Well, no, you'd be a frozen puddle, wouldn't you? Unless you put me in summer and then I'd be a happy snowman. that you still do good. As you embrace your limits, you, little me, we do the little good we can do. Yeah? Do good. Each of them may eat, verse 12. I know there's nothing better for people to do than be happy and to do good. while they live, to find satisfaction in the toil that is a gift from God, in their lot in life, their work. Verse 22, the end of the whole book says it's good to fear God and keep his commands. To do good, do the good that's been given you to do. So it's good to do good. It's good to seek out how to love others, how to tend to the world that you're responsible for, how to use the riches you've been given in a way that multiplies them for the good of others and for the good of the world. Do good. And part of that do good ultimately is fear God, is the way Ecclesiastes puts it. 3 verse 14, God does this so people will fear him. Again, the end of the book, 12 verse 14, fear God and keep his commands. Do good. Fear God. Now, fear God sounds a bit icky to most of our ears, I suspect. Like, does God really want me to be, like, scared of him? That's a bit, like, does he kind of bang the table to surprise me and frighten me? Is that kind of what God's into? Does he get kicks out of that? Fear doesn't necessarily resonate to us. Although, if you've read the Bible a lot, the way you get a sense for how words function is context, right? And as you read the Bible a lot, you start to get the feel for what the Bible means by fear God, rather than what we might think, you know, just as 2026 listeners. And what does it mean? It means to see the good, loving creator, who is also vast and powerful, glorious and holy and good, to see him rightly. He is vast and powerful and frightening, but he's good and loving and kind. That there's a, what is it? It's reverence, it's awe. We have all these other words that basically mean a kind of fear, but a good kind. Yeah? a little bit like how pride can often sound bad, but good self-esteem, well, that's good pride, right? Well, this is good fear. You swap it out for awe, if you want, or reverence, or a grasp of God's godness, a worshipfulness. But there is a sense of going, like, of all the things I could fear, I fear humans, fear disease, fear tigers, I don't know. There's all sorts of things I can fear. What am I going to put actually the greatest concern about? I'm going to be concerned about God above all else. Yeah? And so as I live through time in my little lot, enjoying the life I've been given and doing good, I'm doing it all. Above those heavens is God, not some genie or Santa or spirit in the sky, not some collection of creation, spirit, ancestor entities, but a loving, genius creator who is good and just and fair and kind, who controls it all, isn't fighting with other little gods and angels and spirits, but loves, controls, cares, tends, plans, works out his will. I owe everything I am to him. I depend upon him for everything. That is the way to live life in time. Not in a groveling, wretched fear, but in a good and right recognition of the one above the sun, the one at the end of time, the one at the beginning of time. He's God, I'm not. Hope and life and blessing are all found in him, not me. Christians know he's come into this world, beautiful in its time, to die on the cross and rise again to make me his son or daughter in Christ. That's how good he is. So I take off the crown off my head and lay it before him. Take my plans, my ambitions, my gifts, my desires, lay them before him. Enjoy life. Do good. Fear God. And as you go through time, there's different seasons for that. The vast majority of us here are well and truly young. And Ecclesiastes has a lot to say to you as the young. Come across to chapter 11, speaking about time. What time are you in? Tick, tock, tick, tock. Well, the time you're in is youth. And Ecclesiastes says, well, how do you enjoy life? Do good and fear God as those who are young. Ecclesiastes 11, halfway down. Verse 7, life is sweet, it pleases the eyes to see the sun. However many years you may live, let you enjoy them all. So Andy, Christine, we can still enjoy them, even in this season we're in. But remember the days of darkness, for they will be many. Yeah, okay, great, thanks. But when you are young, the rest of you, Be happy while you're young. Enjoy life. See, same theme. Let your heart give you joy in the days of your youth. Enjoy it. Follow the ways of your heart, whatever your eyes sees. But know that in all these things, God will bring you into judgment. So enjoy your life while doing good and fearing God, in other words. Remember that God's there as you go. Enjoy in the way he wrote the world to be enjoyed. Banish anxiety from your heart, verse 10. Cast off troubles from your body, for youth and vigor are meaningless. Don't idolize your youth. Enjoy it under God. Remember your creator, verse 1, in the days of your youth before the days of trouble come. Now you're young. What are you going to do? Enjoy your youth, your strength, your beauty, your relative freedom of time. I know you're busy, but there's different kinds of busy to come. Enjoy it. And how you enjoy it? It's not pleasure versus religion. Actually, the great thing about true religion, worshipping the Creator, is that actually it's great to live fearing God and doing good. Doing good is actually good for you, and it actually makes you feel good. Worshipping God is actually good for you and makes you feel good, and it's also good, and it's also right, and it also gives meaning to life, and it's also true. So while you're young, don't say, well, I better go and do everything I possibly can in any way I possibly can, however I want to, because while I'm young, I should make the most of it by doing evil, being selfish, living for nothing more than the moment, just pursuing pride or sex or power or fun. I mean, that would be a narrow, thin way to seek pleasure. You want to really seek pleasure? Ecclesiastes says, well, fear God, do good while you're young, and you will actually find great joy and satisfaction and meaning and fulfillment and purpose and connection, and you'll enjoy relationships functioning the way they're meant to be. You're going to be better off. You're going to have a better life in romantic relationships if you're faithful and pure and respectful of others than if you're simply seeking to get it off. You're going to have better relationship to your studies and your work if you see it as good but not ultimate, and so you can walk away from and not be manipulated from others who control your ambition and make you do anything to succeed. You'll actually be free from that. You can walk away from the control freak thing that can happen when you make success your idol. While you're young, get up early, go to bed late and tired. Work hard, serious, true, good, faithful, loving. Enjoy it. Enjoy your life with your youth. Doing good, fearing God. It's a gift from God. The little gifts. Common grace gifts that are just a taste of the big gift of God's salvation in Jesus Christ. We're coming into land just a sec, and there'll be a bit of time for questions after we stretch our legs and stuff. But I just want to finish up with looking to the end of time just a little more. Come back to chapter 3. We've looked at the tyranny of time, how to live in time. Now let's think about the end of time, where it's all headed. Ecclesiastes, all through, keeps hinting at some final justice. Says, oh, that God's got it, but it seems unjust, but maybe there's a future, but maybe there's not. It can't quite get a grip on it, but it says there's got to be something more. Most people feel that. Even those who are atheists, who are nihilists, who are agnostics, have something they want to say that's evil, that's noble. Yeah? So we have some sense of right and wrong, some sense of... So 2 verse 26... To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge and happiness, but to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand over to the one who pleases God. There's a sense of some kind of justice there. Although he then says this too is meaningless, chasing after the wind. So he sees something of this, right? Verse 15, whatever is has already been, what has been before, what will be has been before, and God will call the past into account. So seeing again something, but verse 16, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. So there's injustice in the world, a sense of justice, an experience of injustice. How do you make sense of this? This life is not always like instant karma. It's not always a prosperity gospel. You do the right thing, you will have happy marriage, great wealth, long life. It doesn't always work that way. But every now and then, Ecclesiastes glimpses beyond, sees something more to come, breaks past this end. So 3 verse 17, God will bring into judgment both the righteous and the wicked. There is a time for every activity, a time to judge every evil deed. Come across to 8 verse 11. You see another place where it sort of looks ahead to see something to come. When the sentence for a crime is not quickly carried out, people's hearts are filled with schemes to do wrong. Although a wicked person who commits 100 crimes may live a long time, I know that it will go better with those who fear God, who are reverent before him. Yet because the wicked do not fear God, it will not go well for them. It's a sense that in the end, all the wrongs will be righted. 11 verse 9. 11 verse 9, we read this before, right? Know, at the very end of verse 9, know that in all these things, God will bring you into judgment. 12 verse 13, at the very end of the book, all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the duty of all mankind, for God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether good or bad. An ultimate judgment is a good thing, Ecclesiastes says, because it gives ultimate meaning. It says that right really is right, wrong really is wrong. So judgment, however frightening it might be, and complicated it might be, is a good thing, because it is God saying what you do matters. It's God saying that good is good and that evil is evil. Judgment is a final evaluation that gives meaning and gives justice to a world full of so much confusion and injustice. The violent, the cruel, the abusive, the liars, the scammers, the torturers, the dictators, the bullies won't ultimately get away with it. Evil will be conquered. Our actions will be evaluated. Heroism, sacrifice, kindness will be honoured. But Ecclesiastes says it's so hard to know in this life. Back in chapter 3, it says, I don't know whether the dog's going to go to heaven and I'm going to go to hell. As for the humans, verse 18, God tests them. They may see they're like the animals. Surely the fate of human beings is like the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so does the other. All have the same breath. Humans have no advantage over animals. Everything's meaningless. All go to the same place. 3 verse 20, all come from dust. To dust all return. Who knows if the human spirit goes upward and the spirit of the animal goes down to the earth. Definitely, from Ecclesiastes' point of view, there's very little known. Even from an Old Testament believer point of view, a lot of the grasping of resurrection and salvation and Jesus, that's all still to come. It's a lot they don't know. But, you know, even as a Christian who knows the gospel of Jesus, the resurrection, even then, there's, I don't know which of you will persevere to the end if you're a Christian. I don't fully know. Do you know what I mean? So even I don't fully know everything. I rest in God's wisdom and judgment, in other words, and keep coming back to him in repentance, in faith, in trust, asking him to forgive me, asking him to keep me as I contemplate the judgment to come. I'll wrap up there. Just let me ask you this. Are you a prisoner of time, a slave to the tyranny of time, or have you come to God to find freedom from that tyranny, to see everything beautiful in its time, and to have a hope that goes beyond this life to the life to come? I'm going to pray. Our loving Heavenly Father, we pray that you keep making us wise in our heads, but also in practice, in our hearts, in our lives, in our habits. Please help each one of us, those of us seeking already to know and love and to live for you, others not sure what we believe and needing your help to know what is true, to know if you're there, to know what it all means. Be with us, carry us through the difficulties, confusions, and good things and joys and pleasures of this life, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen. So here's what we're going to do is we're going to have a brief break. It can be a toilet break if you want, stretch your legs, all that kind of stuff. It'll just be brief, just a couple of minutes. And then if Andy and Christine are happy to, maybe you guys can come up and field the questions with me. Does that sound good? And open to questions that was specifically related to today, or, you know, it could be sideways thoughts. That got me thinking of this. What is the deal with that? You can go sideways. But it can also be more practical questions as well, because I've touched on a whole bunch of practical stuff, right? And so you might want to say, how does that work? Or any advice on that? And then we can be some older brothers and sisters, some cool aunt and uncles to you with any of those kinds of questions too. So take a couple of minutes, stretch your legs, and then I'll call you back to your seats for some Q&A. Ball rolling. I'm sure one of you two guys might have been sitting through it going, oh, here's that thing that made me think of this, or Michael should have said that, or whatever it is. Any off the top of your head, either it can be biblical reflections on Ecclesiastes or practical reflections on, you know, living in time and under the sun, all that stuff.
Yeah.
I can start.
Yeah, thanks, Christine.
There's a real sense in, I mean, people often theologize and philosophize about the concept of God's sovereignty, but there is a real rest and reassurance in knowing that time moves on, and while it feels like chaos around you, there is a sense and care that God is holding it all together. And when life feels particularly hard, whether you're young or middle-aged or older, it can feel tempting to press the pause button on time. Yes, the world might be continuing going on around you, but what you can control is what you do and what you do in the world. And so you are going to pause yourself in order to avoid feeling hurt or pain or hardship. But I tell my art students this, that every good, great art piece has an ugly stage. And the artists, if they know that's coming, if they know to expect this, my year eights have embraced this, by the way. Like, Mrs. Jolie, I reached the ugly stage. I'm like, yes, let's celebrate. Silver the wins. You know it's there. But you know that you can get through it and come out on the other side with something beautiful to behold. And our lives are like that too. And the beauty of what we see in the story of Scripture is that God doesn't leave us to live that life alone. Christ, God himself, became human in order to live, and he most definitely didn't press pause and avoid the hardship, but persevered and pushed through, and in that is our salvation.
Good word.
I've got a few things I might be interesting to say. I'll pick one. Thinking about making the moment beautiful, I think everything is beautiful in its time, and I think we can help find that beauty, create that beauty, by considering how do we like orientate ourselves to the moment. So how we relationally face whatever the moment is will help us either find the beauty or create the beauty. And so there's wisdom in that, to kind of, which I think is what you see Jesus is doing, right? So when someone comes along and has a problem or something happens, how does he respond? Well, he responds in just the right way because he's making the moment beautiful. And that's how you see Jesus being wise there. And I think for those of us who see themselves as Christians, that there's an ethic there of going, okay, well, you know, if someone's rude to us, how do I make that moment beautiful? Well, what's your reaction going to be? How are you going to behave in that? Or like I think of my mum's got dementia. And so what does it look like for someone like that who phases time.
Very different experience
very
of time.
Different experience,
yeah.
Then actually me responding to her by not getting annoyed at her because she's told me for like, yeah, we've had a discussion about whether we have a tablecloth or not multiple times over the last hour, is that actually I meet her in that moment as if it's new and hasn't happened and love her in that and are respectful in that. So I think that's a little way as I think about making the moment beautiful can be a bit of a kind of more of an ethical, practical way of seeing that. Right. Yeah.
Questions from the floor? Yeah, Zayda.
The idea of the efficiency thing you were talking about, telling everyone, spending your whole life doing that. I know a lot of people criticize Christians to say, if I thought that a bunch of people were going to hell, I would just tell everyone and spend my whole life doing that because it's really important, obviously. And you kind of push back against that a little bit, saying, enjoy life, be in the moment. Can you flesh that out a little bit?
Yeah, we've actually lived through an experience of this, right? If you really believe there was like a life-threatening virus that could like kill a certain potential number of the population, what would you do? Turns out that a lot of time you still got to like have the meetings with the people and then have the other committee meeting and then do the random trials and then do the tests. And if you rush it too much, then there's complaints that you've released something that could be, you know, harmful rather than helpful, and a bunch of the rest of us can't do anything and so feel there's a problem and all we can do is angrily Facebook about it. And you know, like, as you live through an actual disaster, and this is true for relief workers, all that kind of stuff, there's this weird mix of slow... I've recently been binging The Pit, the TV show about the emergency room. It's weird how slowly they're walking often, because it's all urgent, and you just can't run all the time. And actually, if you ran too often, you'd bump into people, and so there's this weird making haste slowly. I read a book about missions just a month ago, where it said... you don't rush to send people to other countries to preach the gospel because the job is so important that we can't afford to send underprepared workers. Isn't that interesting? Yeah, so all of that means that, like, when a person says, if I believed it, I'd do that, I'd go, no, you wouldn't, because no one does. And secondly, if you did, that wouldn't work because no one wants to listen to some crazy person grabbing them one by one and saying, you're going to hell. Like, there are people who've tried that. It legit doesn't work. So if I really think it's important, then I'm going to work out how does it actually look across a lifetime. Luke, who leads the Focus Ministry, said to me years ago now, over a decade ago, if I'm going to keep doing this for decades, then I'm not going to hand out flyers when it's windy and rainy and miserable because then I won't be doing it in 20 years' time. He's still doing the job of leading Focus. He'll still go and hand out flyers. And maybe it was smart that he didn't do it in the most miserable circumstances possible because if he really believed it, he would. He went, well, I really believe it, so it's going to be important year after year after year after year. Yeah, so there's a few thoughts on that. Yeah.
Now, what are you trying to prove?
Right, right, there can be a macho sort of thing to it. Yeah, that's right.
I think adding to that as well, like, productivity is one way to engage with the world.
Yeah.
And so if you're always thinking, how can I optimize and maximize and be the most productive, the wisdom of Ecclesiastes is it's like there's more to life than that. And so that is just a reality that if you know that, then you'll be wise about thinking, well, yeah, there's an urgency, but there's also a weight. So there's a weightiness, so therefore I'll behave in this way, or there's just more to life than productivity. I think also a bigger picture in the book of Ecclesiastes that we see, my kind of lens, I understand it largely through, is this idea of gift and gain. And that is through the whole book, that actually so much of it is we receive as gift, life and creation and order and time. We don't try to gain from it. And so there's a risk with productivity that we want to make sure that in our productivity, we're not trying to gain and grab and grasp and hold, but our productivity is actually a part of receiving as gift receiving from God rather than trying to get out of the world what we want. Yeah.
Other questions? Amy?
I had a question kind of bouncing off what Andy was saying about kind of everything is beautiful.
Yeah.
So like in chapter 3, it talks about everything, and included in everything is like the time for war and the time for peace. So
whenever you read wisdom type, proverb type stuff, you don't want to absolutely absolutize it, you know, like it's saying, it's a little bit like it says everything that's been before will be again.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the internet wasn't there before, you know, so there are new things, but like the point is in general, and so there's a generalizing to it. But yes, it is saying that, yeah, there is, like, there is no such thing as a perfectly pure, unequivocally just war in this world. So war is hell and horrible and wasteful and vicious, and yet also can be the context for hope, faith, courage, skill. It's a someone laying down their life for others. You know, so there can be good in war, and the most powerful reflections on war capture both. They show the awfulness of it, but also sometimes the grim necessity of it, to go, actually, like, this is awful, but it's the right thing to do. And the best moments in it.
Mm.
Yeah. So, yeah, so even war... I guess a way of flipping it around is to say, in a world where there's evil, injustice and oppression, is it perfectly beautiful for a person to stand by and watch injustice and oppression and rampant kind of intrusion and just sit by with a serene smile and go, what will be, I'm a pacifist. Pacifism is also complicated. It's not like pacifism is completely pure either. It's like, what, you did nothing? You just... let it happen. Yeah, it's a tricky middle ground with that stuff. And going back even from war, I mean, I think we're all friends with people who work in the police force, and they like emergency service staff and like soldiers. It's traumatic being a police officer, and part of the trauma is the complaints that people make about police officers not doing their job well, because they go, well, I know, police officers can be jerks and be part of the problem, but also a lot of them are really trying to do the right thing at great cost to themselves. We need them, but they're part of the problem, but they can also be just the right person who's there and stop something worse happening.
Yeah, I think you've got here the concrete literal, but I'd also say it's wisdom literature, so you've got the concept or the idea. What I mean by that, war, yes, literally war, but there's a, what often it's like peeling onions. You're like, what do you mean by war? Well, you mean conflict, you mean enmity, you mean strife, you mean difficulty, you know, it's actually, there's a time for that. And so yes, at that war level, but also you go, there's a time where you confront your friend or... you say, that's wrong, stop doing that. Or in a church situation, you call someone on their sin, for instance. There's a time where you create a conflict because that's what the moment calls for. And that's a good thing to do. And that's actually the wise thing to do in that time. So there's leveling it down to that as well.
Other questions?
In chapter 11, verse 9, it says, like, follow the ways of your heart and whatever your eyes see it. And then, like, it does go on to say, but know that all these things God will bring you into judgment. But I don't understand, like, why you would even slightly say to a young person, follow the ways of your heart and whatever your eyes see it. And, like, so much of the rest of the Bible, and like, I think just being a Christian in general is about trying to not follow the worldly ways of your heart.
Yeah, embrace... God made the world beautiful, you know what I mean? And so I guess if you could think about it as going like, young man, young woman, if you find someone you really like and they like you, and ask them out. Do you know what I mean? Like, follow the ways of your heart, go do it. You know, or if you really love serving in this way, you know, you kind of try out kids ministry and you go, hang on a second, I quite like hanging out with little kids. That's quite fun. It's like, follow the ways of your heart, go with it. So... there is sanctified pleasure. I mean, look, Ecclesiastes is also messy and mm-hmm. has an irony to it. But I think on one level, I want to say, you know, embrace those godly desires when they're working well. And you go, man, you want a toasty right now? Go and eat a toasty. You gotta, yeah, like that's good. Yeah. Eat it to the glory of God.
Yeah, and so the kind of the objective thing with that is it's stating the wise truth that's how the world operates, and that's actually a wise thing to do is to follow your heart, because that's wise. That's a good way to lean into the rhythms and patterns of the created order and the way God's made us. Now, you're probably feeling nervous because that's pitching against, and the heart of man is sinful, like, you know, kind of all the time, so don't trust it. They're both true. And the wisdom is, don't trust your heart. Trust your heart. But the wisdom is working that out, because there's not necessarily a clear right and wrong. That's what wisdom is. It's how do I live well in the world that God has put me? How do I order myself in such a way where I fear God in all things? And so when you're doing that, you will follow your heart, and you won't follow your heart. Because
it's that easy.
That's wisdom, and that's books like Ecclesiastes. Yeah.
Sometimes you do trust your gut, and you just go, like, it doesn't feel right. And you just go. Sometimes you just go to listen to your gut. Sometimes you got to go. You can interrogate that. Sorry.
I was just going to say, well, it says, I think David said, you know, renew in me a clean heart, Lord. Which, so I think from a non-Christian looking at that, don't follow the desires of your heart, they're going to be sinful. But then when you become a Christian, God renews your heart, and he takes your heart of stone, gives your heart of flesh, and sort of renews what those desires will be.
So there's a bit of Psalm 51 and Ezekiel 36 there, or 34, 36, something like that. They're really helpful references. Good stuff. Thanks, man. Any thoughts on that one? Have we covered that, Christine? Anything you want to add? It's an important question, isn't it?
It is. I feel like you guys have covered it.
Okay. Yes, Esther.
This is never a deep question, but so this is Ecclesiastes 3, for example, like verse 15, it's indented. Is that just poetry structure, or is it referencing something? Or is it just part of the poetry?
Yeah, it's a translation decision in a sense. Like, there's bits with our Bibles where they're not, like, they're formatting decisions, right? So the little numbers, they're not in the original text, so you don't read them out when you do a Bible reading in church. You also don't read the little headings out either. They're added in just to help. Unless you're reading the Psalms, in which case you do read them out. Because they are part of the text. So that's a little trap for new players. But it's the same with the indentation. You'll see, like, different translations will indent some stuff and others won't. And what they're basically looking for is genre clues. And Hebrew poetry, the genre clues are not rhyme. They can be meter, but they're often also thought echoes, thought rhyme
repetitions,
stuff, other structures like that. So, so that's just, they've noticed some of those, some of the meter rhythms and perhaps some echoing there, and said, oh, that could well be that he's fallen into poetry at that point. Yeah.
So another example where you'll see that is Genesis 1 and compared to Genesis 2. Genesis 1 appears to be a form of poetry, whereas Genesis 2 appears to be a form of narrative. Also, quotation marks, also like not in the New Testament. And so, like, John chapter 3 is a fascinating one where the translators will make a choice between, well, where does Jesus stop speaking to Nicodemus? In the famous passage of John 3:16, is John 3:16 Jesus still expounding on the idea of what it is to be born again, or is this John commentating on what Jesus means by it? There's no quotation marks in the original text, and so translators are making a choice there.
Okay, we'll finish on a not so deep question about formatting.
Sound dirty, but
another not so deep question.
Yay.
Is Ecclesiastes 3:20 where the saying all would come from dust and all go to dust again come from?
It goes right back into Genesis 3. So it's one of those clues that Ecclesiastes is reflecting on at length. It's almost like Ecclesiastes 3 is like Genesis 3, the musical. You know, it's this kind of like, it's this expansion upon it. And so that's one of those clues that we are to think about Genesis 3. It's such a beautiful thing that there's got woven into like Anglican and Catholic funeral liturgies. And even like Ash Wednesday dwells on that as well. Those of you who went to, the, you know, that kind of Anglo-Goth sort of service. So that's again like one of those cool intertextual things across the Bible. Yeah. Hey, keep up the chatting with each other. You can enjoy it and chat about silly things or deep things or jump back and forth between the two. But Jacob will close out the night for us with some other general comments.
Thank you, you three.